something that we almost feel guilty about if we have. Anger in their culture is sometimes vicious and compulsive and arbitrary, but very often a very wholesome, direct response to the situation. The immediate, concrete, honest response to a situation. So they know perfectly well that Yahweh is good, that what Yahweh does is good for them. So they talk about Yahweh getting angry. They're being there's a strong statement of that at the end of this text, and so one of the things we keep having to wrestle with is the distance between how we feel about anger and how they felt about anger. And in many ways, I think the healthiness of the expression of emotion, both with their freedom to think about God getting angry, and on the other hand, the other picture that helps us bridge the distance, I think, is the Wailing Wall outside of Jerusalem. The freedom to weep. We're in a culture in which people talk freely and express feelings appropriate to some of the messes they get into and situations they get into. I'm collecting images of prophets. The Isaiah belongs to a group of figures from the 8th century BC in Israel who are sort of the normative sample of prophets for us in the West. The Hebrew scriptures is arranged where there are two kinds of prophets. The former prophets, whom we label in the English Bible the historians, they regarded First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings, as the former prophets, the people who commented on the way things happened, on narrative, sort of preachers about history or theologians about history. They called them prophets. And then there were another group that they called the latter prophets. And this group was largely what we have left of them is largely a series of texts. More images of prophets. I want a few more images of prophets. We've gotten wise, intimacy with God, threatening, sometimes full of righteous anger. Then we have a cluster of concrete images of one very concrete, bald beard, staff, mouth, white robe. Any more images of prophets?
Seems to like foretell destruction of the people. Or tell people to change their ways or they'll destroy.
All right, now you're talking about what they said.
Yeah.
You're talking about the preaching of the prophets, and you're emphasizing the notion of their insistence on change, and you're emphasizing their foresight. I want to make a point of distinguishing foresight and prediction. Not the word either. Prediction is all right. I'll put prediction with foresight. I want to distinguish that from fortune telling. There's a very popular picture of prophets that something like fortune tellers in a circus. They get sort of high on God, and all of a sudden they have these huge dramatic flashes that map out the future. And we picture them as somehow totally anomaly, some sort of strange, psychologically strange figures who somehow are used by God in a mechanical way, as a kind of TV picture of what is going to happen. There certainly is a strong element of vision, and then from this picture we get all wrapped up into prediction and fulfillment, and a kind of use of prediction and fulfillment to deal with our anxieties about things not being true. And there's a kind of syndrome of use of the prophets, which has some elements that are authentic to the prophets, but a great deal of our own need to prove to ourselves what we are not convinced of. So that I like the word vision, I like the word foresight, I like this the image of someone who has very sharp eyes and can see all the way across the valley. Last night, some of it bred of profound intimacy with Yahweh, some of it bred of profound exercise. We went star watching last night with Karen, and I couldn't see half of the stars that some of the other people were seeing, because my eyes aren't tuned in to see all of the stars. And some of the people clearly had years of intent looking that enabled them to see the stars that were really there. And think about the word vision. That vision is very important. This because much of their speaking grows out of images and perceptions. And I'll have a little bit more to say about thinking of them as poets before you think of them as preachers. Pictures of prophets. There's something luxurious about imagining these figures. There's something worthwhile about probing their psychology. What enables persons to become insightful and become the carriers of messages and insights. If you will thumb through Isaiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are what we call the four major prophets. And then there's a group of 12 that we call in the English classification minor prophets, but which in the Hebrew Bible were simply the Book of the 12. And the difference between the major and the minor is that the major wrote are long collections and the minor wrote are small. So it doesn't mean, it means the long-winded ones and the short ones. So that, in fact, in the Hebrew Bible, you have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the Book of the Twelve. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, and the Book of the Twelve. So that you have a group of five. And everything should come out five because there were five books of Moses. So that whether they were five in the beginning, they were certainly five when they came out in the canon. Remember a canon, not a boom boom, but a measure is a community book. It's not an encyclopedia, and it's not a research set of tapes. It's a community book like a hymn book. And so much of how it gets put together, not what's in it comes out of all sorts of life situations, but the way it gets put together has much to do with how we use it as where it comes from. So you mustn't try to deduce where it comes from simply by how the book is arranged. So as an example of this is that we have these fivers who are put together in group because they were fundamentally speakers, preachers. There are a few stories. Prophets didn't begin with these figures. There are a story of Nathan going to David and telling him what he didn't want to hear. There's stories of Elisha and Elijah, and there the Elijah stories are pretty sober but the Elisha stories get fantastic. In fact, it's hard not to imagine that these are stories that got souped up a little bit for the Boy Scout lessons, and so that you have really only one of the other things. You have really only two places in the Old Testament where you can probably. But this will probably may get some more comment on this from Norm when he starts talking about miracles. Most of the time, most of the people in Israel perceived God working in ordinary ways. Most of the time, most of the people perceived God working in ordinary ways through kings and priests and language and courts and everyday life. The only two major blocks, there are two major blocks where people, the only way they could deal with those experiences was in terms of stories of wonder. One of them is with the plagues and the redemption, the liberation from Egypt, and another is with the Elijah and the Elisha cycle. So when you come to people like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, there are little bits here and there that you piece together about the people, but almost nothing about them as persons. You won't find any description of their face or feet. They were, somehow or another, they were as uninterested in the prophet as a person as we are, say, as uninterested or as moderately interested in the prophet as a person as we are interested in an Eliot or an Auden. What they put out for use and reuse was their texts, was their poems. Okay? So when we come to this group, we're coming to a group of texts from figures like prophets who may have been like our popular image of prophet, the sort of clairvoyant who is high on Yahweh. Others may have been much more like, Isaiah was probably much more like a Reinhold Niebuhr or a John Foster Dulles than he was like somebody performing the latest the latest dream. And the other thing we have in this text, let me, at the very, one of the, very often when we come to these prophets, we keep spending our time feeling guilty that we're not like them and we can't preach like them and we feel we ought to be like them. Don't worry about being a prophet or becoming one. You know, this group is the best preaching from about 750 till about 300, selected by popular use over several hundred years. So don't ever worry about whether you're a prophet. Get it? If you have something to say, say it, and the people later than you and the Spirit in her good time will... the Spirit in her good time will help the community decide which messages are worth saving and using over again. So you can study to be a priest, you can study to be a judge, but prophets are elected by God and the people, and when God and the people agree, then you have canons. Okay, context. So this was Isaiah, and he's a maybe royal. He's one of the noblest. His language is the most lyrical. This is 8th century Judah. He's a Yahwist in theology. He's a poet. He's a poet. And I'm very concerned that we begin by thinking of texts from poetic texts so that we don't short-circuit the substance of the text. We use the Bible a lot like people who have the TV audio on, but no pictures. And as we get out, very often we go after these biblical texts to get out of them the theology, and then we think about the ideas. Now, what they didn't save theology, they didn't save formal reflective writing. What they saved in these texts were strong poems. Poems which, where the first impact, I mean, there are kernels of theological insight that you can write volumes about, but where the first, they didn't crack the peanut and throw the shell away and save the theology. What they had was something more like a carrot in which the word and the idea were organically the same thing. They really didn't have a even a body-soul kind of dichotomy. They had persons. So that there's a kind of, if you throw away the poetry, then you're missing the sort of time bomb effect, the sort of the chemical action of these texts, because the texts are very dramatic poems which get under your skin and begin gradually to reorient a person's way of proceeding. Let me kind of illustrate this with chapter 1 of Isaiah, and it's important that you bring your texts and so that you can see certain things. I want you to notice, sometime, if any of you are interested, we can start a conversation about what makes text work and this sort of thing. Well, those of you, how many of you have Bibles with you? Well, those of you who have Bibles sort of show up. When those of you who don't, sidle up. move over to the people that have. I always used to look at pictures as though I were looking at the, simply look at the, you know, the design. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me that I had, in order to see the design, I have to see where the design isn't as well as where the design is. You know, I've got to see the spaces in order to see the line. Okay, one of the first things about a text is you've got to hear the stops. You've got to hear the rest. And the same thing with music. Music isn't continuous sound. It's sound and not sound and sound and not sound. And it's the contrast between the sound and the not sound that give you melody and give you effect. So texts are basically spaces as well as meaning and words. And the way we signify rest notes in a text. Now words are not, most of these happened orally before they were written down. And what you've got in front of you is a text, something like a musical score. And you have to work to translate the score into language, into meaningful, coherent language. So notice the spaces. I struggled for years to find the theme that went all the way through the book of Isaiah. And then finally it became clear that this is a collection of poems, and some of them don't have anything to do with each other. And they don't connect, and some of them within a poem connect like the act of one play and the act of another play. You have to figure out what has happened between this act and this act. So watch for those spaces. You have spaces that actually mean this one has nothing to do with this. The other thing that got hung up on for a long time, I kept thinking that the chapters ought to be the end of the poem. You know, and that's not how the chapters got there. The chapters was a fairly mechanical way, chapters and verses are a fairly mechanical way of dividing a thing up into even sections so that you can find a particular part of a poem. In fact, the legend is that they were done on horseback from Paris to Marseille, and that every time the horse jogged, that was the end of a verse. So, you know, sort of, you got to block out the chapter and verse except for finding a particular place. Okay, spaces. Let me illustrate. Verse 2, verse 3, the ox knows its owner and the ass its master's crib. Israel does not know, my people does not understand. End. New act. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers. The other thing I want you to notice is not the spaces, but the pronouns. This is extremely important because the dramatic effect in these poems is largely accomplished by changes of voice. Changes of voice. And they are much more like Greek tragedy, where you have several different voices, and the early Aeschylus started in with only a couple of voices and a chorus, so that you, in order to unpack the impact of these, you really need to catch the voices. Now, you have a little help from the English editors in that when Yahweh's voice, Yahweh is a bodiless voice in space. Yahweh is a voice without an image, without an image. The Jews worked very, very hard to, although voice is very human and anthropomorphic, they've worked very hard to control the anthropomorphism and not let people turn Yahweh into another Greek figure, another Greek polytheist, by refusing to make images. They allowed Yahweh to have a voice, or Yahweh had a voice for them, but he had no form. And the forms that he had from the old Near Eastern religions, they eliminated. And we can see the different ways of distancing Yahweh. So you have two things going on. Yahweh is, on the one hand, very close. This voice kind of erupts inside of you or next to you or from across the street. And on the other hand, when you get to language in verse 4, the Holy One of Israel, you're talking about a voice very close, out of distance, out of someone, some space, some place that has some perspective on our life. And so the voice comes. Yahweh doesn't come. The voice of Yahweh comes. Almost like a well in the desert, or almost like the first star, or almost like the top of the mountain comes out of the cloud, this voice. And it's alternated with the voice of the prophet. So that you notice in verse 3 you have quotes, in verse 4 you don't have. Then again you have Yahweh speaking. And what I'd like to do, I'd like to just to get, so that you get the sense of this, and this may be as far as we'll be able to get today, so that you get the sense of this change of voice, I want somebody to read. Mary, you game to read the Yahweh part? Okay, and I'll just comment a little bit as we go. Notice how it goes. The first part is superscription. It's label. It's book jacket. So it really the poem really begins with two, and this again is sort of the way the prophet, the literary prophet, prophet does it, frames the Yahweh oracle. Notice that in verse 2, you invite the heavens and the earth to listen. And in verse 10, you invite the citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah, really citizens of Jerusalem, but sort of re-personified as the citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah. And notice this wonderful flow between the people and the earth. There wasn't the big distance between the humans and the earth, so that the prophets speak as easily to the sky as they do to you, so that there's a feeling of empathy. And in fact, one of the most strongest ways to speak to you is to speak to the sky, because then the sky echoes the voice, and the earth rumbles, and these, so hear, O heaven, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken.
I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me.
The next.
The ox that knows his owner, and the ass his master's crib. But Israel does not know, my people does not consider.
Okay, very short, very concise. A metaphor about fathers and sons, although this is essentially Yahweh talking about a nation, but there's this strong, intimate father-son language that creeps in. The simile, the ox knows its owner, the ass its master's crib, but Israel does not know. There's where you get the straightforward descriptive language in the next thing. Okay? Sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity. Hebrew poetry is repetition. Notice now how the next line repeats the previous line. a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, sons who deal corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. This is a different perspective. The people see the prophet as the funny, alienated, discontented figure. And the prophet is announcing that he's not the odd one. He's not the stranger. He's right where he belongs. He's got his feet right in Torah. But he's doing some consciousness raising, trying to get the people to see that they are strangers in their own land. Not strangers in a strange land, but strangers, aliens, in their own land. They have lost their sense of belonging to their place and to their covenant and to their Torah. Okay. They are utterly estranged. Okay, now, end voice of prophet, Yahweh voice.
The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot, even as there is no sound in it, but wounds and bruises. As creatures by a sword, they have not been clothed, neither bound up, neither mollified the ointment.
Okay. The picture of a person with a disease, leprosy, venereal disease, some kind of external, some kind of thing that shows itself in wounds which have not been dressed. That isn't just big ideas. That's the picture that the prophet presents of the people. A very ill person who has not been attended to and has not attended to themselves. Notice there the analogy, and notice how the prophet patterns analogy, description, analogy. Now you move to direct speech. This is the heart, this section here gives you your best clue to the political situation of the people. Your country lies desolate. The prophet foresees really a period in which Jerusalem will be destroyed by the king of Assyria. Your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, aliens devour your land. It is desolate as overthrown by aliens. And the daughter of Zion, Israel was male, the land was female, and the city was female. So that in a sense, the Israel and her place, or his place, formed a kind of community that was people and land and male and female. And the daughter of Zion is left. Marvelous, whenever the prophets want to picture the most their most lonesome picture is of the picture of the woman left abandoned, left all alone. And the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we should have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. I don't know the agricultural details, but they're the things that are set up, you know, for the people either to sleep in or store their the huts in the at harvest time. So that after the harvest has been taken and the people have left, they've gone off to after the grape harvest or something like that, you know, they've gone off to the partying and to the tramping out the grapes and making the wine, and what's left in the vineyard or in the cucumber field is just the empty lean-to. It's lean-to, it's a shack, you know, it's left there. And so that on the one hand you have this notion of abandonment, the picture of abandonment, and then you have a more realistic thrust with the like a besieged city, the picture of the bread and butter of their life as a small country. They're rather like, you know, the Balkans and the Baltic states. The bread and butter, or they're rather like Israel today, the bread and butter of their life is of a small country surrounded by large countries, and they were besieged for a number of years by the emperor of Syria and so on.
Would you go back and you had another voice come in at 5, and my Bible doesn't have a quotation mark, although it has quotation marks in the other spots here.
You can really do that both ways.
Oh, okay.
You can, if I follow the editors, and I could as easily do it that way.
Yeah.
In fact,
I just wondered why you decided that that was not that voice.
I think what puzzles me about it, why I'm differing, choosing a little bit to differ, is that later on you'll have the rhetorical questions are Yahweh's voice. But this isn't clearly one or the other. The way you tell the voices, it's a very simple literary thing. When Yahweh will talk about, but they have rebelled against me in verse 2b, so that clearly means that the speaker is Yahweh. And when you get to 4, you have, now Yahweh can speak in third person, but you have no evidence that it's Yahweh speaking. So you watch for the pronouns. You get the what in verse 11, what to me is the multitude, and then come now, let us reason together in verse 18, and so on. Okay, let's, that's as far as we've gotten. And I suppose the way to sum that up is that there is here a voice, two voices, the voice of Yahweh, reinforced by the voice, elaborated, commented on, by the voice of the poet preacher, calling people to reorient their consciousness from viewing themselves as well, from viewing themselves as healthy, from viewing themselves as productive, to viewing themselves as strangers, as in some sense diseased. And instead of viewing security and prosperity ahead, you know, just look at all we've accomplished, just look at how great resources America has, just look at the security we have, we'll go on forever and ever. Instead of looking at themselves as secure, looking at themselves as vulnerable. The great effect, the great consciousness-raising thrust of the threats of the prophets is to try and reorient the consciousness of the people to see their vulnerability, the concrete vulnerability to outside enemy in the case of Israel. Because Israel, and you know, it took no, the odd part is, the minute you turn it around, it's obvious to the whole world that they're vulnerable. The only people that can't see they're vulnerable is themselves. It's like, it's obvious to the whole world that America is vulnerable. The only people that can't see it are people who are securely encased in a middle-class standard of living and protected from the obvious perceptions that, number one, we've got limited resources, number two, we've got plenty of enemies, because we've taken a lot of things from people that belong to them, and we've got plenty of lack of integrity inside. So we're not generating a reputation that anybody ought to trust. And it's this reorientation to seeing Israel as strangers on the one hand, seeing themselves as strangers and as vulnerable, that is the major thrust of what I would regard as the first act of a two-act piece. Now, tomorrow what we'll do is review this a little bit and then pick up with 10 and go through 26.